This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember the record producer and engineer Phil Ramone, who died Saturday at the age of 79. He won 14 Grammys. He started his career as an engineer, recording singers like Leslie Gore, Dusty Springfield, and Dionne Warwick. He went on to produce recordings by Paul Simon, Billy Joel, Barbara Streisand, Ray Charles, and Tony Bennett, as well as the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's Passion. Ramone pioneered long-distance recording techniques when he produced Frank Sinatra's Duets albums. I spoke with Ramone in 1995. We started with one of the records Phil Ramone worked on at the beginning of his career, Leslie Gore's You Don't Own Me.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me.
Phil Ramone, welcome to Fresh Air. What was your role on You Don't Own Me?
I was the recording engineer, working with Quincy Jones, who was the producer, and Leslie, who I think was 14, maybe 15 at the time. It was one of those overnight amazing records for both. I think we had done Judy's Turn to Cry first, and It's My Party was her first hit. And within a week, they believed that she was going to become a star. So the rush was on to record these songs.
So did you record everybody together, or did you bring them in at separate times?
No.
It was all together.
Yeah. As opposite as it is in the 90s, it's just the way it was then. I mean, bands, recording orchestras, rhythm sections were particular groups of people who were brought together who played well together. And it was very much an in thing to have certain kind of rhythm players for this kind of music, the triplets in the right hand of the piano, maybe one of the greatest jazz pianists. You never know who was in the band. Strings always showed up with the cigars in their mouth and the newspapers and played incredibly well, bored to tears with this kind of music at the time. That was an elite group of people who played that kind of, not just that kind of music. They'd gone from that to a Johnny Mathis session or Rosie Clooney or a play with Toscanini during the week. They didn't have much patience, and if you were an engineer, if they didn't hear themselves well or something, we never used earphones in those days. People had to play acoustically in a room. At the time, I had designed this funny little booth to isolate the singer from the band, and it was sort of considered a little bit out there. But it really helped, and mainly because we needed to get some kind of attitude going. In those days, it was also illegal to overdub. And overdub meaning to put your voice on after the orchestra had left.
Why was it illegal?
Well, it was just a union rule. I mean, you performed, you recorded, and you were done. And many things were done behind locked doors later because eventually certain singers were not comfortable singing live. So the producer would say to me, make sure we have a clean vocal so we can change it. And that's hence the building of booths.
Right, you needed an isolated booth for the singer so that you could re-record their vocal without and also that you control their control their volume without also controlling the volume of the orchestra.
Right. I mean, sometimes the band got so loud in the room, and, you know, any singer could be overwhelmed by the band.
I'd like you to describe what the control room was like when you first started engineering.
Studios were rather simplistic. They did not do multi-track recordings when I started. It was two-track was a big deal. The key to it was mono, believe it or not. The studio I worked at was a demo studio first. And you'd come in with a song, and we were capable, because there was a bass player and a guitar player and a piano player, to create a demo for you in 15 minutes. And we would double-track, meaning we would I'd play six fiddle parts in a minute.
Oh, you do the parts yourself?
Oh, sure.
For the demo?
Yeah. It taught me, you know, and engineer it yourself. So you run between the room and you start the machine and you run out there and you've got one bar to get there. It wasn't a very large studio, so
Did you save your demos?
Yeah, no, actually, I didn't. You know, they're acetates, probably. Economics were, you kept the tape for a week. If they wanted to pay for storage, $1 a week, they would pay for it for a month. After that, it went into the reuse file.
Too bad.
Yeah, life was very, very sort of organized in it. But, you know, that pain has hit me twice in my life since then. Once I lost a complete library of a room where the economic crunch had come, and somebody said, you know, we have all those metal reels, so let's go down there and take the metal reels apart. We'll cut the tape off, and we'll start with, at least we won't have to pay $2 a reel. So I lost a complete library. I was away working that summer. And on some project. It's amazing how...
It hurts me to hear that.
Oh, it kills me. I'm trying to get labels and everybody else to pull out tapes and realize that you may have... It's not about money.
Preservation. Yeah.
Yeah, you may have a Dylan rehearsal. Right. God knows what's sitting in somebody's basement.
I want to ask you about one of the recent recordings that you produced, and this is the recording, the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Passion. Wonderful recording.
Thank you.
I think there's a style for doing cast recordings that's maybe different from any other kind of recording.
Oh, yeah.
What's different about it?
You need to record everybody in one day because that's what they give you. One whole day to record everybody. It's exhausting but incredibly challenging. And you create the stage for radio, or like an old radio show, and you create the best of those pieces and you edit them quickly to make some kind of sense.
Was Sondheim at your side?
Every minute.
Any interesting advice?
He's a particularly bright, bright man with a tremendous musical taste and a following that'll go on forever.
Phil Ramone, I just have a final question that you've probably been asked a zillion times. Do people ever confuse you with either Phil Spector or the Ramones?
You bet. Both of them. I get Phil Spector on the street sometimes, and the Ramones, it's a constant. We went to the MTV Awards this year, and Joey and I sat together. Really bizarre. Oh, it's a constant question.
So what are the mistakes people make?
Well, they think Wall of Sound, Phil Ramone, and it's not. Uh-huh. Phil Spector is definitely... The Ramones, of course, I take full credit for any of their success, and they take it from me, too. We just love... There's an interesting love there. It's 20 years of punk, you know. I like people who have another side to the music than just the straight ahead.
Right. Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Phil Ramone recorded in 1995. He died Saturday at the age of 79. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from the first album of Frank Sinatra duets that Phil Ramone produced. This one features Tony Bennett.
Start spreading the news. You're leaving today. Tell him, Frank.
I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
Your vagabond shoes, they are longing to stray
and step around the heart of it.
This Sunday, AMC presents the 2-hour season premiere of Mad Men. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, promises not to give away any key details, but he does have some things to say about the return of what he calls one of television's very best series and about today's TV dramas in general.
For decades, when broadcast television called the shots and dominated the TV landscape, the biggest event of the year was the fall season, when networks would unveil their new shows and return with fresh episodes of old favorites. But now, because of cable and satellite TV, the fall season isn't the only game in town. There's the summer season, which used to be nothing but reruns. Now it's the time when HBO brings back True Blood, and when AMC, in just a few months, is going to present the final episodes of Breaking Bad. There's the winter season, when we get new episodes of Justified, Girls, and House of Lies, and just finished a batch of exciting new Walking Dead episodes. And now we come to the spring TV season, which, as in nature, is a time to rejoice in the spirit of rebirth. Game of Thrones is back with its strongest season yet, and so is Doctor Who. And best of all, there's AMC's Mad Men, which begins Season 6 on Sunday, delivering all the pleasures that today's most ambitious drama series can bring. Way, way back in the 1970s, NBC used to present a rotating series called Novels for Television, and all the networks then were big on miniseries adaptations of popular novels. These days, the best weekly drama series are the Novels for Television. As with the classic soap opera form, loyal audience members get to know these characters so intimately that subtleties of plot and personality carry echoes not only of recent episodes, but from earlier seasons. Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, has established his own narrative rules for his Emmy-winning drama series, the continuing story of advertising executive Don Draper in the 1960s. On Mad Men, the breaks between seasons sometimes take longer than a year, and when the show returns, it doesn't pick up where it left off. It leaves a gap, and viewers have to start each season as though they're the ones who left and have to catch up. What year is it? What's the status of Don's marriage? And what's going on with all the other people in and around Don's life? Those are the very basic questions that, as each season begins, Mad Men is eager to protect. And I'll honor that, so you can tune in Sunday and figure it out for yourself. But my favorite moment from the two-hour season premiere is one that reveals something only about Don, played so sparingly and perfectly by John Hamm. It's in a setting so familiar that it could be any year at any time. Don, with his fellow advertising team, is pitching a new ad campaign to his clients. Those who have kept up with Mad Men know that this is the place where Don Draper thrives and shines, where he can come up with just the shimmery language and images necessary to seduce his clients like a snake charmer into seeing and raving about his vision. This time, the clients own a luxury hotel in Hawaii, and Don has come up with an ad campaign that doesn't show the hotel at all, just a set of footprints in the sand leading into the water and vanishing. Don spins his magic while the clients react, and Don's colleagues, Smarmy Pete and Loose Cannon Roger, chime in. But this time, for the first time, Don's verbal seduction doesn't have the desired result.
I think we're not selling a geographical location. We're selling an experience. It's not just a different place. You are different. And you'd think there'd be an unsettling feeling about something so drastically different, but there's something else. You don't miss anything. You're not homesick. It puts you in this state. The air and the water are all the same temperature as your body. It's sensory, the music, the fragrance, the breeze and the blue. Stan?
It's just a sketch.
Hawaiian legend has it that the soul can go in and out of the body, but that it usually leaves from a leeward point into the waves. Hawaii, the jumping off point.
So, what happened to him?
He got off the plane, took a deep breath, shed his skin, and jumped off.
I assume this is a photograph.
Four color.
That water is transparent. Well, I suppose it reminds me a little of the cinema. But mostly I see James Mason at the end of that movie walking into the sea.
What is that movie?
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
He's killing himself. I don't think they show it, but he's going to swim out until he can't swim back.
That may be a personal association for you, but that's not what this means.
We looked at this. None of us thought of that.
A Star is Born.
The copy is all about the Hawaiian legend. Aloha means hello and goodbye.
I'm sorry, but this is very poetic.
Thank you.
Where's our hotel? Where's the Pink Palace? And Diamond Head. They gotta have Diamond Head in the shot.
Anyone can do that.
I don't agree.
I'm guessing, and this is only a guess, that this will end up being the primary theme of this new season on Mad Men. It'll be Don Draper losing his touch as the 60s march on. It'll be Don Draper doing in the show what his drawn caricature does in the beginning of every episode as the opening credits play. He goes into freefall, surrounded by all the images of happiness and desire he helped create.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. John Myers directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Okay, so Frommer's guidebooks will stay the same. The Tonight Show is changing. This is a long-running television network drama, the saga of NBC easing Jay Leno out of the chair. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, Leno will be replaced next year by Jimmy Fallon in a show based in New York City.
The course of late night never did run smooth. Not two decades ago, when NBC brass vacillated between David Letterman and Jay Leno. Not a few years back, with the abortive run with Conan O'Brien. And not last month, when the top-rated Leno joked about his bosses with some edge.
Well, you know the whole legend of St. Patrick, right? St. Patrick drove all the snakes out of Ireland, and then they came into the United States and became NBC executives. It's a fascinating...
It was one in a relentless series of punchlines at the network's expense, mirroring Leno's genuine anger. But viewers detected an easing earlier this week as Leno joined Fallon in a duet set to the tune of West Side Story's Tonight.
So the network said, here's an idea. Pack your bags, take a hike, NBC.
The skit reflected the two hosts' rapport, but NBC has a raft of other problems. It's had a rocky ride in primetime. It fell from first last fall to fifth in February in the ratings, behind not just the other broadcast networks, but the Spanish-language network Univision. And in the morning, the Today Show has been deposed by ABC's Good Morning America, costing NBC pride and many millions of dollars. Speculation is so rife that host Matt Lauer will be replaced that the network has had to deny it. Of course, last month, NBC denied Leno's long stint was about to end, too. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
On this Friday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Well, Mad Men is back. The signature cable drama returns on Sunday. This seems to be a great time for shows on cable. Last Sunday, 25 million viewers combined tuned into the basic cable shows The Bible and The Walking Dead, blowing away the biggest scripted show on broadcast TV, The Good Wife. This all got us wondering if we're seeing a convergence of sorts between broadcast and cable. NPR's Netta Ulaby looked into this and encountered some pretty gruesome storylines.
Ratings are easy to measure. Last year, 40% of the top-rated shows in key demographics were cable. Only a decade or so ago, it was more like 4. But it seems like a qualitative convergence is happening, too. When a bloody zombie cable show like The Walking Dead gets historically high ratings, that's deadly serious for the broadcast networks. So they're trying to be just as disgusting, with new serial killer shows like Hannibal on NBC and The Following on Fox.
Kill her!
When it comes to this kind of thing, television critic Eric Deggans has coined a phrase.
Imitation is the sincerest form of television. Anything that works on TV is going to be cloned.
Let's return, for a moment, to a simpler era, when hit shows drew more than 20 million people, and the battle for ratings was waged between only 4 major broadcast networks.
For a long, long time, the networks had the home field advantage in that people's TV dials and their TV watching habits were all kind of oriented around broadcast television. And then when cable channels sort of came along, they were these exotic extra things.
Who's here, my baby?
Things like a channel designed for older women, says media studies professor Amanda Lotz, that for a while was a leader.
Lifetime was the most watched cable network for a period of 18 months in 2000-2001, and I think a lot of that had to do with that they had this very clear brand. At that time, Lifetime was television for women. They were creating original scripted shows with female leads when they weren't on broadcast networks.
But no one would have used the word convergence back then. Lifetime shows looked cheap and stamped out. Cable channels lacked big broadcast budgets, so they had to fill vast tracts of their schedules with reruns of broadcast shows. Do you remember when it felt like Law and Order was on every time you turned on cable?
The problem with that is that inevitably that doesn't fit your brand exactly because it wasn't created for you.
Lotz says cable channels gradually realized there was promotional value involved.
And the thing about scripted programming or the original scripted programming is that they can make it match their brand exactly.
So the cable channel TBS is comedy. That's why it picked up a broadcast show, Cougar Town, when ABC dropped it last year. Now it's producing original episodes. FX is edgy. It's getting broadcast-level ratings for its original scripted shows, like American Horror Story, or the one about a not particularly law-abiding motorcycle gang.
Sons of Anarchy is a motorcycle club. And just for your information, I haven't been charged with a crime, gun-related or otherwise, in over 7 years.
According to FX president John Landgraf, basic cable shows started to look more expensive with the launch of his network show The Shield and Monk on USA back in 2002. Since then, he's seen a remarkable jump in the sheer volume of scripted shows.
When The Shield launched, there were about 30 scripted original series in basic and premium cable. There were 125 last year. And I think they'll be well over that this year. Could be 140, could be 150.
Still, Landgraf is not seeing complete convergence, not yet, between scripted shows on cable and the ones on broadcast.
What broadcast shows have done is you always have to see the consequences instantaneously, right? It has to happen within the hour or very shortly. So you have to always see, essentially, that crime doesn't pay and bad people get punished and cops generally win. You know what, these shows like The Shield and The Sopranos, they're more like Shakespearean tragedies. You know, Macbeth doesn't get his comeuppance until the fifth act.
Maybe that's how we'll know convergence has really arrived, when we're watching Macbeth, the series, on Fox or ABC. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.